Hey everybody, welcome from the Enlisted Association of the National Guard's National Office in Washington, D.C. We're here reporting from 1 Mass Avenue Northwest, just right across the street from the United States Senate. I'm Scott Balsam. I'm one of the legislative directors of the association.
And I'm Daniel Elkins. I am the other legislative director at the National Office.
Well, this is our first podcast of 2018, and as we've said in some of our recent episodes, we plan to do these regularly. But just keep in mind that by the time you hear this, some of the things Daniel and I discussed could be out of date, but keep checking back for future episodes. Before we get really started in our discussion, I want to remind everyone that we have our 2018 Legislative Workshop here in Washington, D.C., Legislative Workshop and State President's Workshop, February 4th through 7th, so here about a month from today, actually. And information is available on ingus.org, and if you're not signed up to attend, I hope you do so, and tell your friends and family.
Excellent for that introduction. Thanks, Scott. So today we're just going to talk to you guys about a few things that have happened over the last month or so during the holiday season, as well as some things that we're going to be addressing in our legislative conference. And then we're going to open up a discussion between me and Scott and hopefully get some responses out of all of you. So again, feel free to email me or Scott at any point over the next couple weeks in reference to what we've talked about at daniel@ingus.org or scott@ingus.org. So I'll start. I've got three main topics that we're going to be really addressing during the legislative workshop. The first and foremost is the Education Reauthorization Act, or HEA, which stands for the Higher Education Reauthorization Act. This is the massive piece of legislation that governs all things via the Department of Education, and it really happens about once a decade. It's been almost 10 years since the last time it happened, and it has been long overdue. The reason it's important is because it affects all students, but specifically it affects veteran students. And it affects veteran students because it changes how the Department of Education monitors and tracks accountability. And there are a lot of students that have been going to schools and have been mistreated, and the department's aiming to correct that. So we're widely supportive of the bill. We think that the new accountability metrics that are introduced in the bill are really going to substantially change higher education as a whole. And the biggest one is moving to what's called a risk share for the schools. So currently, right now, students can take Title IV loans out of schools or student financial aid. And if the school is a bad school, and you get your degree from the school, and you went to that school because you thought you could get a degree and you could get a job from getting that degree, and you're unable to get that degree, or I'm sorry, you're unable to get that job and unable to pay back your student loans, all of that burden falls on you. So the Department of Education, in conjunction with the Senate Help Committee and the House Committee on Education and Workforce, are moving to this risk share model, which essentially says that if your institution reaches a threshold where 20% or more of people are defaulting on their student loans, then the school is going to have to start helping pay back some of those student loans, because the school was the one that received the money. The student directed the money, but the school is the one that received the money. So that's a really interesting change from right now, which basically says the school's off the hook and the student is on the hook. And we firmly believe that institutions need to be held accountable. The other interesting thing that we are going to be asking for or fighting for in this Education Reauthorization Act is a carve-out for student loan forgiveness for veterans. Currently, in the new bill, there's no carve-out. There's no carve-out that says student veterans can continue to receive student loan forgiveness. And we think that military service is one that is a great burden, and that the country owes that that veteran the ability to have student loan forgiveness after they have served in the military for a certain period of time. So that's the biggest thing that I'm tracking, and that's the biggest thing that's happened since the last time we've had a podcast. I'll get into two other issues, but I wanted to give Scott a chance to share his number one and then number two issue.
Yeah, okay. And I'm happy to do one, and then we can just kind of ping pong.
Yeah, I like that. We'll play a little game of ping pong. Right. A little badminton here.
The two I'll bring up are actually holdovers, quite frankly, from last year. One, we got accomplished 12-304B. We got a number of benefits parity accomplished with the post 9/11 GI Bill and with pre and post mobilization health care coverage. What we didn't get accomplished was early retirement credit and some tuition assistance. And so Representative Palazzo of Mississippi and Representative Walls of Minnesota introduced language on the House side to truly combat all the 12-304B inequities. But as seeming as a few of those items got addressed, we're working with their offices to try to determine if we need to drop a new bill that just addresses the things that weren't accomplished, i.e. tuition assistance and early retirement credit, or how we want to go about accomplishing it in the second session of 115th Congress. So that's probably nothing new to most of the folks who are listening to this, as we are just now moving into the second session and trying to go back and clean up some of the things we weren't able to accomplish in the first session, but we're making progress. And it's a process, and so Rome wasn't conquered in one day, and so we're just taking it a step at a time. But that's one of my updates, and I'll ping pong it back over to you.
I gotcha. All right, so one of the other things that has come to our attention here at Ingus has to do with doctors in the VA. The VA has known that there's been a shortage in doctors for a long time, and they have been doing what they can to attract new doctors to the VA. The interesting thing that we have just been made aware of through multiple doctors that are currently at VA facilities is, in an attempt to close the gap for healthcare, the VA has hired multiple physician assistants and have also hired multiple nurse practitioners. They have been empowering both the physician assistants and the nurse practitioners to operate on the same level as a doctor. So we've been hearing from a lot of doctors that have issue with this because the continuity of care and the level of care is significantly different. And in some cases, you have nurses or nurse practitioners that are telling patients that they're doctors, which is not the case. So we are going to be addressing that in a very, very big way when we have meetings up here on the Hill. There's nothing wrong with hiring physician assistants, or there's nothing wrong with hiring nurse practitioners, but they're not doctors, and they shouldn't be given the same level of ability to give healthcare to patients unsupervised that a doctor has, because their schooling is significantly less. And in this no way takes away or detracts from the skill that they bring, but they're not doctors, and people are being misinformed. And one of the other big issues that surrounds this issue is because they have not been trained as proficiently, they typically order more tests, more blood tests, more diagnostic tests, more radiological tests. And as a result, they're costing the VA considerable more amount of money per patient than a doctor that has a better expertise in order to diagnose. So that's something that we wanted to make you guys and the podcast nation aware of, and it's something that we're going to really start to address in 2018.
Now, that's really interesting, because I mean, I'm not an expert on this like you are, but conceptually I understand that some of the just healthcare costs writ large, you know, outside of the VA, are a lot of the costs are associated with lab tests.
Right, exactly.
So I mean, I think as a country we're grappling with some of those as we look to reform healthcare overall.
Right, exactly. And I think one of the interesting conversation points is just to address from a very high level, well, what do we do with doctor shortages? You know, if more people are becoming physician assistants or more people are becoming nurse practitioners, then how do we adjust? Is there a way to incentivize people to be military or VA doctors? And, you know, those are things that I'm trying to figure out right now. But as you said, that the rising costs in medical care has more to do with diagnostics than it does actual physician with patient care.
There has to be, and again, this is caveating with not an expert like you are, but there has to be some type of cross-pollination, because with the rising cost of healthcare, there's also the rising cost of health care education. And so there's got to be some way that there's really good doctors out there that want to serve and serve their country. And if they're at a university basically that's in an area where there's a high amount of, like, let's say traumatic injuries, whether it's gunshot wounds or, like, you know, near interstates where there's high velocity crashes, that, you know, that's pretty good training for going down range. And quite frankly, the likewise, I mean, if you're down range, you're seeing a lot of, you know, catastrophic injuries that all of a sudden you're back in a high trauma center in an interurban ER a hospital that's close to a highway. I mean, there's got to be ways that you can cross-pollinate that level. And then on a completely different scale, there's got to be a way that, you know, if you're at a VA, and I mean, you're in an area that's a VA is populated with more families, you know, that's just general practice. So if you're a doctor and you're not looking to get into the, you know, the gunshot wounds or the, you know, the trauma, but you want to just basically be a general practitioner, that you would think that there's got to be a way that you could cross-pollinate someone who wants to go that route. So those are two different extremes, but there's got to be some way that you could alleviate costs by incentivizing people to serve their country, and then also you can place people based off of their expertise in really great places.
Yeah, I think those are really good points. You know, Podcast Nation, we'd love to hear from you, your suggestions. One of the things we constantly are faced with is a budget. There's only a limited amount of money that we have, and we have to fight for more benefits, or fight to keep benefits on the table. But with that, there's always the association of cost. What is the tax increase, or what is the cost, and what program may we need to cut that's not working well? So we'd love your feedback. We'd love your feedback. Scott, what is your second issue?
Second issue is, like I said with the first one, something that I think most folks on here have probably heard me talk about before or write about in magazines or in updates. In 2017, we are still fighting for TRICARE Reserve Select coverage for federal employees. Obviously, that's a large technician population, Daniel, that you and I represent. The beautiful thing, and you know, this is a process. We got really close last year. The language was in the NDAA. It just didn't make it through conference there in October, November timeframe. Senator Hatch introduced a bill on the Senate side, S-101086. And when the Congressional Budget Office scored it, there, you know, and you're talking about the cost associated.
Right.
And,
yeah.
You know, there's a cost associated with removing this population of members of the reserve component who are also eligible for TRICARE. Removing them, they're forced into the federal employee health benefit plan, where they can pick some pretty robust coverage, but they're definitely come at a higher price tag. And so removing that population, and I'm pretty sure that the Department of Defense has identified 113,000 people are eligible to do that. In order to remove them from that population in FEHBP and putting them at, you know, TRICARE covered by the Department of Defense, OPM, Office of Personnel Management, covers or operates the FEHBP. There's about a $241 million price tag, and that's mandatory spending. But the beautiful thing about it is there's a $1.5 billion cost savings in discretionary spending that the department would realize.
So help explain this to me, because this is something that I think the listeners would really appreciate. Like, just give a little overview of the difference between mandatory and discretionary spending, and how that can save the government money.
Yeah, well, and it's just different colors of money, really. So, I mean, mandatory spending are the thing, Medicare, Medicaid, you know, TRICARE, tuition assistance, or post 9/11 GI Bill, the types of things that we are, like, the government is they've signed a dotted line. They have entered an agreement with the American people, or service members in this case. Discretionary spending are things like, how many tanks are we going to build? How many planes are we going to build?
I gotcha.
All that. How many bullets are we going to buy? Those are decisions that can be moved up and down depending on the overall budget threshold or the, you know, well, quite frankly, the administration, what Secretary of Defense thinks, what the American people think when they have, you know, they elect a president. Like, all those things are, they change over time. But mandatory spending, I mean, the government is on the hook.
Makes sense. Okay. All right, well, definitely keep us posted.
Definitely. We're hoping we can get it across the finish line this year. I was really optimistic we could do it last year. Senator Hatch announced his retirement the other day, but he is still very keen to get this thing through, and he's still the Finance Committee chair, and he has senior staff, obviously, on that committee, but also throughout the United States Senate, and we're looking for a champion on the House side, and we're moving in the right direction for sure. I'm very optimistic. I was optimistic last year, but we'll hopefully get this thing done this year.